How turbulent does the world feel to you right now? How much pressure are you under? How equipped do you feel to continually pivot to meet the challenges of tomorrow? How overwhelming does it sometimes feel to continually rethink your strategies and priorities? In a world of almost constant transition, we need the capacity and the tools to navigate increasing uncertainty and complexities. Our successes yesterday won't necessarily make us successful tomorrow. As Marshall Goldsmith once wrote, "What got you here won't get you there." In this show, we are joined by Michael Watkins, professor of leadership and organizational change and a globally recognized leadership transitions expert. He has developed proven frameworks and tools to help leaders authentically navigate personal and organizational change challenges while remaining true to their deeply held values and supporting their well-being. This is something we need now, perhaps more than ever before. This brilliant conversation between Michael, John, and Arjun is filled with refreshing, incredibly valuable insights that will help you strategically navigate the pressures you face every day with the agility that success requires. So give this episode your full attention. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome to The Evolving Leader, a show born from the belief that we need deeper, more accountable, and more human leadership to face the challenges of an uncertain, polarizing, and automating world. Today, I'm joined by my colleague and growth and entrepreneurial expert, Arjun Saheb. Arjun, how are you feeling?
Hi, John. I'm feeling fantastic. Really glad to be back after a month of parental leave. So I'm a little sleep deprived. I'm definitely feeling glad to be back in the hot seat. So feels good. John, how are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling great. I'm excited about your new arrival, your beautiful baby daughter. And I thought, you know, this is like a little gift to, you know, sort of bed you back gently into the world of work. So that's good. But personally, I'm feeling very excited, and especially because today we're joined by a true thought leader. Our guest today is Michael Watkins. He's best known for his international bestseller, The First 90 Days, Proven Strategies for Getting Up to Speed Faster and Smarter. And he sold over 1 million copies of that book, so just not many people manage to do that. He works with C-level suite executives, global organizations on transition acceleration, primarily through Genesis Advisors, the international leadership development consultancy he founded. And he's also a professor of leadership and organizational change at IMD Business School, where he teaches a popular virtual First 90 Days open program for leaders in transition. And he's also just published a new book, which I absolutely loved. I've read tons of books on strategic thinking and strategy and so on. And I wouldn't say my heart kind of like freezes a little bit when I see another one coming out, thinking, is there going to be anything new? But this just really cut through and just provides what he's brilliant at doing, which is providing just insightful, highly simple, practical ways that are incredibly powerful of helping people to think differently. So really love that and very excited to get into to talk to him about this. Michael, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, John and Arjun. I have to say, though, you know, one of the first pieces of advice I give to people about transitions is be careful about expectations, right? And be careful about shaping expectations, right? So thanks a lot, John, for that wonderful and somewhat terrifying introduction. So,
oh, well, I'm sure you're going to live up to it. Don't worry.
Well, welcome to the show, Michael. How are you feeling?
I feel wonderful. You know, I think I'm living, you know, the life I would want to be, you know, leading personally and professionally. It's exciting, daunting, occasionally terrifying times out there. I get to kind of work with leaders as they grapple with it and kind of, you know, look over their shoulders while they do it. And it's really fascinating these days. And I'm super looking forward to talking to you about it.
Well, that's so lovely to hear. And John had just mentioned some of your publications. Well, it's been 21 years since you published The First 90 Days. And it's remained a bestseller and the go-to guide for executives taking on new roles. What do you think it solved in terms of the problem that made it so successful?
Yeah. Well, I should start, Arjun, by saying that I was in my early 20s when I published that book originally. That's a joke. The original edition was published in 2003. I published a second edition in 2013, and I'm getting close to finishing the third edition because a lot has changed, and maybe we can talk about a little bit about that. But look, I tell people that I'm the accidental guru, right? I didn't set out to plan to do this exactly. I was quite happy teaching at Harvard. I was mostly teaching negotiation, and I just got interested in the subject, you know, and it became pretty clear that although there was lots out there about leadership and lots out there about change, the consolidation, right, of those things happening to you as you go into a new role and have to be simultaneously going up the learning curve, even as you're trying to make change happen in the organization, hadn't really been dealt with. Yeah. And you have to keep in mind too, this was before all the work on onboarding happened. You know, it was basically a green field when I wrote the book. And I, you know, timing is everything, right? I think catching the wave is a wonderful thing to do.
I've recommended the book to many people, but also leaders are finding themselves that even not in formal transitions, but their roles are changing so profoundly, they might find themselves with a raft of new challenges without even any acknowledgement being given to that fact. What do you see is happening in the world at the moment, and how do you look at that kind of transition?
So I think it's such a good point, John, and I call these the hidden transitions, right? I mean, we've got the visible ones that are easy to see when someone joins a new organization or gets a promotion, but, and you know, we were talking about this a bit before we started the recording, right, about just how turbulent the world is right now, and you know, the pressures that leaders are facing to rapidly pivot, you know, and rethink their priorities, rethink their strategies. So, you know, it sometimes feels like leaders and, oh, by the way, their organizations are going through almost continual transition these days. Yeah. But a lot of it isn't, you know, it isn't obvious, right, when it's happening, when a team's direction changes or when a leader realizes that they need to fundamentally rethink their strategy. I mean, that's as much a transition as joining a new company, but it's not as visible to your point.
Mm. Michael, you talk about two major challenges facing leaders in transitions that I'd love for you to unpack a little. Firstly, knowing what they need to learn and change about themselves. And secondly, the change that they need to lead in the organization. Could you give us some insight into how those two dimensions can work together in a kind of constructive, symbiotic way?
Yeah, so I think both of those are critical, right? And I think maybe I'll start with the organizational challenge first, Arjun, if it's okay. Because you're right, I do juxtapose that kind of, you know, organizational challenge with the personal challenge. But the organizational challenge, you know, really profoundly shapes the personal challenge, you know. And I mean, an example would be the framework I built called the STARS model, right, for a startup, turnaround, accelerated growth, realignment, sustaining success. That's not the sum total of all possible business situations you can face. Most leaders get a mix of those things when they take a new role. You know, people still find it useful, right, as a way to think about, you know, what do I need to do coming into this new role? And I think of it as a kind of situational change leadership, Arjun. I mean, I look at these things as distinct types of change challenges. I mean, starting something up is a change challenge, right? Turning something around is absolutely a change challenge. Accelerating growth, scaling, right? There's been a lot that's been written about scaling is a transformational challenge. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think getting your arms around the core of the challenge you're facing, and then beginning to go from there to what's the implications for what I need to do as a leader situationally, right? By the way, we can have a conversation about authenticity and situational leadership if you want. I think that's a pretty interesting dimension to this too, right? But I'm a big believer in situational leadership. I mean, I think leaders absolutely need to flex in the face of the demands that they're facing and the particulars of what their team needs at any given point in time, right? So that's kind of the organizational side. The personal side, I always riff on this off of Marshall Goldsmith, right? And his wonderful book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. The biggest trap leaders fall into when taking new roles is thinking that they're going to continue to be successful doing what they've done in the past. And it can even be reinforced when you're hired, right? You know, Arjun, we want you to come in and do what you did at, you know, your last company, only more, right? Well, maybe that's really what they want, but it's as likely that that's not exactly what they want, right? And it's even more likely you're not going to just come in and do that without creating a lot of resistance and and challenges, right? And so I, early on, when I work with my own clients, focus them really laser beam like on what are you good at and love to do that you need to do less of? And what are you maybe not so great at and maybe not so comfortable with that you need to do more of? Yeah. And so to me, that's kind of the core of what you need to give up and what you need to embrace when you go into a new role. And those things kind of then intersect, right? The situational challenges that flow off the organizational side intersect pretty powerfully with what the leader needs to do. Does that make sense, Arjun?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'd love for you to actually touch on the authenticity piece as well, because I find that really, really intriguing. Yeah. I think that can inevitably help supercharge what you're just talking about.
So I'm a Canadian originally, so you're gonna get a little bit of semi-Canadian humor here. But my father, who was very, very funny, funny person, used to have little sayings, right? And one of his little sayings was, always be sincere, whether you mean it or not. Yeah. And so, you know, there's no question that, you know, leaders need to perform and not perform in the performance sense, but perform in the acting and playing a role sense. You mean, and it intersects again directly with situational leadership, right? The way you're going to show up into a turnaround is going to be very different than the way you're going to show up into a sustaining success kind of challenge, right? And we don't want to sort of minimize the importance of that. As you go to more senior levels, inevitably you are under more scrutiny. People are watching your every move and trying to parse out what it all means. Yeah. And so, you know, you need to think about yourself as being on a stage, right? Playing the lead role, you know, in your organization with all the implications for role modeling and the power of everything you do symbolically. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, now you could, you know, hear me say that, and you could hear Michael thinks the leader should just be whatever the situation demands, right? And, you know, flow with it. And no, that's not what I mean, right? And the conversation around authenticity, I ground in values fundamentally and leadership values, right? If you're not living according to your leadership values, then that's inauthentic at a fairly fundamental level. But you can adapt to lots of situations and still remain fundamentally true to your leadership values. And that's authenticity to me. That's the way to kind of undo the Gordian knot of, you know, situational leadership and playing a role versus being authentic. That's the way I see it. Yeah.
And one of those situations that is perennially difficult is when you're promoted. It often comes with the reality that you're leaving your peer group and then you're leading them. How do you do that successfully in your experience?
So I think there's so many great, there's such a great example, John, and there's a few different dimensions to it. I mean, one is just the act of being promoted and what the transition challenges associated with that are, right? I mean, I'm going to get to your question about leading former peers in a sec, but I just want to step back a little bit, right? You know, anytime you're promoted, your scope broadens, right? So how you delegate needs to change. You're further from the front lines typically, so how you communicate needs to change in some fundamental ways. I'd love to tell you that politics becomes less intense as you go to the top of organizations, but that would be a lie. So you need to be more capable from a political savvy point of view when you're promoted typically. And then there's this question of presence. Yeah. And I'm very interested these days in leadership presence and trying to unpack a little bit what that means. I just had an article come out on the Thinkers 50 website about my view of leadership presence, and we can talk about that if you're interested. So all that is to say, you've got serious work to do anytime that you're promoted, right? And there's a retooling of yourself that you need to focus on. Yeah. Now you just, you added the complexity, John, of, and it often happens, right, where you're promoted to lead former peers. And in an ideal world, it's obvious to everyone that you should be promoted and everyone's happy for you and on with the show, but it's equally likely that it comes as a surprise to some. It comes as a disappointment to some, right? And you've got to kind of manage your way through that thicket of reworking relationships, right? Establishing yourself, you know, in a position of greater authority without overdoing it, right? You know, no Napoleon, you know, no General John, you know, kind of showing up in the organization, right? So there's a real balancing that has to happen when you do this, and it's delicate. But, you know, I think we, you know, if you pay attention to the right things, do things in a way that, well, one piece of advice I always give to folks in that situation is focus laser beam like on what's good for the business. Anchor everything you do in what's good for the business, right? Try to let go of the personal, whatever it is, right? And have some confidence that'll carry you through. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the compulsion to try and please your peers, either to mollify their resentment or frustration not being the one, or your old friends trying to make them feel somehow that you've got their back in a way is a difficult set of emotional challenges.
Absolutely.
And I love the idea that you have something that you can anchor. You're not resisting these things, and you know, you're actually anchoring yourself on an outcome that we all share. That pulls you forward and pulls them forward with you, I'm imagining in this situation. Where do you see it going wrong? Because I'm sure you see it going wrong quite a lot.
Yep. So as you were saying that, you triggered another thought in me too, right? Which about this, which is having the team that was formerly your peers see you out there doing battle on their behalf is another way to anchor things, right? You're out there representing them, getting resources, enabling them to do great work. It's another anchor point you can use, and you triggered that thought for me. Where does it go wrong? I think a couple of ways it goes wrong, right? One is continuing to behave like super peer in a leadership role. You know, so continuing to basically do some of the work that you used to do while you're trying to be a leader, but not really being a leader because you're still a little too cozy with the people on your team, perhaps. And I can see it go wrong that way. It's rare, but occasionally you see people who, you know, the power just kind of goes to their heads, and they start thinking, okay, I, you know, as I said, General John has arrived, and all grudges will be, you know, will be rectified. And, you know, or I guess not quite the same thing, but a variation on it is you've got all this pent up demand for internally for what you want to do. And you try to, like, you know, in a very short period of time, make all those things happen. So you're kind of overwhelming the organization in some way. Those would be, I think, examples that I'd point to.
Hi, this is Emma Sinclair, business psychologist, occasional co-host, and fan of the Evolving Leader podcast. There are now over 100 episodes with an incredible list of guests encompassing a broad range of disciplines, all handpicked by us to help you, our audience, understand and overcome your greatest leadership challenges. We have so much more to come. So wherever you get your podcasts, please subscribe, share, rate, and review. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
Michael, you said something earlier that stuck in my mind, this idea of needing to retool yourself. And part of that mix that's really critical is your well-being. Because you talk about the need to maintain your well-being, including your family's needs. So I wonder how you think about that, particularly in a transition where it involves perhaps uprooting to a new city.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, obviously, you're in an interesting time in your life right now, Arjun, and I'm sure that's, you know, you're going through it. I have to say, just completely parenthetically, I remember with my first child, the day that I got a full REM cycle of sleep, right? And suddenly became a human being again, you know, like, hurrah, here we are, like, whoa.
I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, it'll happen.
So there is light.
Light at the end of the tunnel. For sure. And, oh, God. And obviously there's tremendous joy.
5 years away.
Joy in the midst of it, right? And I have three kids. They're all grown now. But I think I was, you know, we were in diapers for close to a decade, right? So, you know, there is, you know, I don't want to depress you, but that's, you know, that's definitely in your future. So I guess a couple things, right? I mean, again, I'll try to ground it in the way I kind of think about things, right? I increasingly view leadership as fundamentally being about energy and about how you mobilize and focus and sustain the energy of your team and your organization. Yeah. So that's where I kind of begin. And that's not management, because there's lots of management stuff you need to do. That's the leadership part, right? It's about how do you energize people, focus that energy. To your point, Arjun, super important, sustain that energy, right, in your team. And then, you know, the way I describe it is you can't hope to mobilize and focus and sustain the energy of your team and organization without being able to mobilize and focus and sustain your own energy. And so, you know, and that sustaining part is really important, right, especially today when there's just extraordinary demands and pressures on people. So absolutely, you need to be focusing on that. I'll address the transition issue first and then come back to the more general one, right? During transitions, you need to surge energetically. You just do, right? And you know, my view of kind of energy management and leadership is there will be ebbs and flows, right? The danger is when you start just continuing to be on a curve of putting out so much energy that eventually you're gonna fall, right? So when I coach people, I say, look, you know, you're going to be in surge mode for a while, right? Some things are gonna drop away. You're not gonna get as much exercise. You're not gonna get as much sleep, right? You're gonna do the best you can, you know, but this is the reality of what you're gonna be going through. However, we're gonna set a date, right? Where you're going to start to transition back to something more sustainable, right? We're not going to let you continue to drive yourself in the way you need to drive yourself during that transition. You have to have a transition point back to something that's more sustainable. So that's, I guess, one aspect. I think you also mentioned the family, and you know, again, not a great metaphor, so forgive me, right? But I tell the leaders I work with, look, you need to help your family understand that you're going away to war for a little while, right? That you're going to not be as available, not as accessible. You're going to be more tired, more distracted. To your point, Arjun, you may be in temporary housing in another location while your partner is trying to clean things up back where you are. You may do things like not move right away because you want your kids to finish the current school year. You know, there's lots of good reasons to not move. And that creates real pressures on relationships, you know. But it's worse if the partner isn't on board with what's happening, you know, understanding what's going on, seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, figuratively. So that's kind of the way I sort of think about it. And there's no easy answer, right? I mean, you know, transitions, they just demand a lot out of you if you're going through a significant one.
There's an area I'm really interested in your thoughts on, which is you advocate future back thinking to help executives shape that leadership role from day one, so they're stepping into the future. And we know that imagination can be quite a challenge for certain individuals, but particularly have kind of groomed a very pragmatic mindset, and they're more comfortable with the now forward approach, the goal forward approach. Can you talk about how you've helped your clients to envisage the future more successfully?
So I try to make it really as concrete as possible, John, you know, and so what I say is, first of all, it's important to pick a time frame, right? Pick it, I call it an era, right, of time, and say, okay, we're going to be talking about the next 3 years, or 2 years or whatever the right time frame is. For sometimes when people are ready to transition out, it's going to be, what are you going to do in the final year in this role, right? So, but pick the era, pick the time frame you're going to be dealing with helps. And then I push people on two questions, you know, and which I think help clarify people's thoughts about this. I say, at the end of that era, what do you want to be true? And by true, I mean, what do you want to have accomplished? What do you want your legacy to be? When you tell people the story of this time in your life, what do you want that story, that narrative to be all about? And that helps, I think, with the, making it a bit more concrete. So it's not some, you know, glorious vision of the future. It's, by the time I'm there, I will have, you know, largely completed the transformation of this organization. Or we will have largely put in place the digital processes that we're launching currently, right? And I try to get people to be pretty specific, right? So question one is that what will be true question. And the other question, which I think is equally important, is at the end of that era, what will be possible for you? And by possible for you, I mean, what options will you have created for yourself? What, you know, resources will you have accumulated? What relationships will you have built that will lay the foundation for the next era that you're going to go on, right? And so that's the sort of exercise that I take people through, John. And you know, mostly it seems to help. It seems to help. And you know, people are more likely and more intuitively going to think about what they'll have accomplished than to think about what's the work that they're going to do to create the set of options and resources and relationships that'll then take them onward, right? I'm working with a senior R&D leader at a big pharmaceutical company right now. And, you know, he's got a few more years in role. But beyond that, you know, he's looking at multiple possibilities, right? Should I continue? Will I get into a more senior role in this organization? But hey, maybe I'm going to go out and start another company, which he did before he took this current role, right? And so asking the question, you know, how do you want to focus some portion of your time to lay the foundations for both of those things, right? To be seen more as an enterprise leader, that prepares you for the more senior position in the organization, building that external thought leadership profile so that you're more, you know, you're recognized when the time comes and you know, private equity firms are in that space and ready to invest in you. It's that kind of thinking that I encourage people to do.
Michael, I love that question, what will be possible? And it's just made me think, in your recent conversations you've been having, given the backdrop of developments, hyperspeeded developments in AI, how is that question changing? How are the answers to that question changing for people that you're talking to?
It's just such a good question, Arjun, and such an interesting time, right? You know, I again, just background, you know, I think we live in absolutely extraordinary times. And, you know, my mantra personally is every day is a new adventure, right? Now, sometimes those adventures are wonderful and sometimes they're awful, but never a dull moment, you know? And it's kind of like that for leaders today. They're living in this, just this incredible, you know, tumult, right? Of trying to deal with things. And partly that's just the political, economic, you know, usual social stuff, but technology has got everyone in a whirl, right? And that's in part because it's moving so fast, right? And I think that what I see leaders struggling with, you know, is how fast to move with this technology, because if you don't go fast enough, you know, it could be the end of your organization, potentially, right? But the flip side is if you get going too fast and the technology is advancing faster than your implementation is, you know, you're going to have made investments that arguably may not have been, you know, particularly good ones. So there's this real tension I see leaders facing about how fast do we move with this and how do we do it safely and how do we decide whether we're going to do more internal, you know, kind of employee facing or internal operational applications or more externally facing customer impacting applications, right? But I just, you know, I think that the bottom line, well, again, back up. My son runs a AI startup in Toronto, focusing on HR these days. And he sent me the link to ChatGPT, you know, about 10 days after it was released in November of 2022. Yeah. And so, and he said to me, you know, Dad, you need to look at this, right? And so I was, you know, I was in it pretty early and I've stayed pretty engaged. And I was probably the first faculty member at IMD that really got to grips with AI. And, you know, there was this initial, oh my God, it's going to change everything. And then there's been the inevitable counter revolution of, you know, oh, it's all overblown, you know, I'm sorry, but it's going to change everything. It's absolutely going to change everything, right? We are just in the calm before the storm, in my opinion, right? And the calm, what the calm consists of is organizations figuring out how to really leverage this technology, right? And begin to truly implement it at scale. And when that really begins to, you know, take hold, I think we're going to see absolutely astonishing magnitude of change in the business environment. And that's not even, I mean, I guess coming back to your question, right? The other thing I say to leaders these days is don't focus on where the technology is exclusively, right? Anticipate where the technology is going to go and what some of the implications will be, because it's developing so rapidly, right? You know, what's GPT-5 going to look like? 6, 7, right? What's Gemini Super Advanced going to be like? What is Claude, you know, 15 going to do for us? Yeah. But it's also kind of scary because there's people that believe that there is nothing that these systems won't be able to do, you know, in terms of, you know, human capability, right? Where does that take us? I mean, you know, so anyway, I'm not really truly answering your question, Arjun, other than to say it's super hard to grapple with these challenges right now. Yeah. But what do you think? I mean, I'll turn the question around if that's okay. What are you seeing and thinking about this?
So I think there's a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of where this is going to take businesses and also new business models. I think 100%. That there's going to be a nexus point between some of these emerging technologies like AI, Web3, and, you know, kind of biotech, and a range of others. That's going to completely blow our minds, and I think it's coming faster than anyone could even imagine. I think that the struggle is going to be making that transition. I'm thinking particularly about people like, you know, cousins I've got that are coming out of university and wondering what they're going to do with their careers. The struggle is going to be making that transition between something that's quite traditional to, you know, I want to be a future leader, a leader of tomorrow. And I'm faced now with this unprecedented situation where all these emerging technologies are kind of coming together at once. And it's so hard to predict. So I feel it's quite overwhelming and heavy. But I feel immense excitement.
Yeah, I know. And that's not mutually incompatible, right? I mean, I think there can be both, you know, incredible excitement, real trepidation, but we want to see what's going to happen, right? I was at dinner with one of my program groups, you know, so I teach a program at IMD called Appropriate Enough Transition to Business Leadership, right? It's one of IMD's big executive programs. And we had it's a two-week module kind of course. And so we have a dinner at the end of the first module. And one of the participants, you know, introduced a really fun little thought experiment. He said, if you had a one-way pass to any time and place, past or future, where would you go? Well, that's pretty interesting, right? He then proceeded to say that, you know, he said he wanted to go to a certain time, and his wife was outraged because it was a one-way pass, which I thought was hilarious. But I mean, it's just a thought experiment, but let's be frank, we're not actually embarking, right? But my answer to the question was I wanted to go, you know, sort of 500 years ahead of where we are, right? And he said something interesting, which he says that, you know, the vast majority of people want to go back to some place. I don't want to go back anywhere. You know, I can read history books. I don't need to do that. You know, I can go reenact battles, you know, if I want to, you know, if that's what I'm interested in. I want to see what happens, Arjun. I want to go far enough ahead that all this will have arguably shaken out to some degree. the climate, you know, the technology, you know, I guess the worry is that I'll arrive and be the sole human being, you know, kind of on the planet. But I don't really think that's what will happen. I just think we have no idea, right? We have no idea what it's going to look like in 500 years, but I want to know. You know, I want to see what happens. And I'm really disappointed and annoyed that's not going to happen, unfortunately. So.
Well, who knows? I mean, there might be some technology that preserve part of you to go and experience it in the future. Yeah,
exactly.
I coming back to your thought about, you know, how do we navigate forward? I think we've been looking for the last 5, even 10 years at this notion of the fourth industrial revolution. It hasn't actually been that revolutionary in terms of change. I mean, there's a lot of change, but it hasn't been that level of seismic disruption that you've seen in past industrial revolutions. For a lot of people, it's been quite incremental in many respects, and this feels like it's going to be that point where many parts of the economy globally and nationally are going to be disrupted, and people's careers are going to be upended, and education systems are going to be upended, and so on, in a very short period of time. And so it makes me think about trying to distinguish between the possibilities of new business models and what human beings are actually for in those, you know, and actually figuring out, you know, the things that only human beings can do at every stage. And I don't think a lot of executives are asking that question. They're still looking, they're projecting forward the assumptions of the past about how you staff an organization and so on. And, you know, if I think about 100%. The things that you have been saying, Michael, in this conversation, they're all incredibly human problems that you're describing. You know, the reality of what it's like to be in that human state around things. So, you know, your well-being being a massive source of competitive advantage, because if you've got more energy than other leaders, that's a source of value. You get more done in less time. Absolutely. And you inspire and motivate people. And so I think those things of energy, of situational understanding that an AI model can't do because it's only fed with what it's got, decision-making, forming enriching relationships and so on, those sources of human value creation are going to be the things to focus in on if you want to manage your career forward.
I completely agree with you, John. I think the point you just sort of alluded to there too, right, of the kind of looking at the now and projecting forward, and I see this related thing, and I alluded to it briefly, right, of treating the technology itself as static, right, as opposed to something that's just going to continue to build and build and build, right? And whenever I hear someone say, well, AI can't do X, I always say you want to add yet to that sentence, right?
Yeah.
AI can't do that yet, right?
Yes.
But there's, you know, there was a big study done, you know, a couple months back of over 1,000 AI researchers. And one of the questions was, how long will it be before AI can do everything the human can do cognitively, only better? The outside estimate was 2040, right? That's pretty extraordinary, you know? So you also, I think something, I just want to grab something you said too, John, about previous industrial revolutions, right? So, because I wrote an article recently about general purpose technologies, right? And the idea that, you know, we've seen these general purpose technologies, and, you know, steam was an example, electricity was an example, the internet, I think everyone more or less agrees, was a general purpose technology. And a general purpose technology is one that has these vast economic and social impacts and kind of enables a lot of other technological developments. And I can't imagine that people can't argue that this is a general purpose technology with all of what that means. And in that article, what I did that was, I think, interesting was I looked at the timeframes for the, you know, 75% implementation of those technologies. You know, steam, it was 100 years, right? Electricity, it was 60 years. You know, internet, it was 20 years. AI, what's it going to be? 5? 10? You know, I mean, it's, you know, and I think, yeah, you know, human beings are remarkably good at adapting given time. And that's my biggest worry about this one, is not that we're not able to adapt, but it's going to happen just so fast that it's going to be super hard and very disruptive as a result.
So that's a depressing latest. No.
You both stop there. This isn't the you. Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, it's the end of the week, and you know, like,
yeah, exactly.
Bringing us down, Mike.
Exactly.
No, not at all.
I'm kidding.
But I do want to shift to your latest book, because this is an incredibly succinct blueprint for how to think differently. So I want to start with your definition of strategic thinking, because its meaning is fairly elusive when you ask executives often, I think.
Yep. So again, if it's okay, I'll just a tiny bit of context, right? You know, so I mean, the conversation we just had and my thinking about it is one reason I wrote this book, right? Because I truly believe that strategic thinking is one pillar of what's going to help people get through this. Business leaders lead their organizations through this, right? And I think that I don't think there's been a time in recent memory when strategic thinking, you know, has been more important than it is right now. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm sort of working with this idea of these kinds of three pillars of, you know, moving into the future. And strategic thinking is one. Adaptive organization, and especially adaptive culture, is the second, right? Because if you can get focused on the right things as a result of the strategic thinking, you still need to have your organization move rapidly enough to make the changes necessary. And then the third piece is kind of resilient leadership, right? Which is, how do you help leaders deal with the enormous pressures, right? So that's my little triangle. Strategic thinking, you know, to get to your question directly, one of the reasons I thought this was a great book to write was exactly what you just said, John, which is people do not have a good definition of what it is exactly, right? And, you know, you talk to leaders about this, and, you know, it's not uncommon for them to have been said to them at some point in their careers, you know, Arjun, you need to become a better strategic thinker, you know. You need to work on your strategic thinking ability, Arjun, you know. And Arjun kind of goes, okay, you know, like, what exactly are you telling me here, right? And there was very much in the interviews that I did for the book, I know it when I see it kind of thing, right? And that's just not good enough, right? It's just not good enough, because you can't help people understand where they are. You can't help people get better, which I believe you can help people get better, right? Unless you've got a reasonably, you know, clear view of what it is we're talking about, yeah? And so I think one of the contributions, at least I hope one of the contributions from the book, is to try and clarify some of that, right? And clarify at a few different layers, you know. So first of all, it's about thinking and not about strategy, right? There's plenty of works out there about strategic planning, strategic analysis, strategic frameworks, you know. So I feel like that's kind of covered. And you won't find a single reference to that in the book, and that was intentional. Right, there's no reference to classic strategy frameworks anywhere in that book. You know, what I wanted to focus on was the thinking part, right? What's the thinking capabilities that let leaders do things like envision the future, right? Or navigate through complex political systems, or connect the dots between different trends that are emerging in the environment and know what's important out there, right? The thinking is the focus, not the strategy, right? Now, the thinking has to be in aid of doing things that are strategic for the organization. Strategic meaning longer term, bigger picture, more directional in their orientation. Yeah. So then, you know, and then I reached back to some work I actually did with a colleague at Harvard, probably more than 10 years at this point, which is a book that I wrote with a guy named Max Bazerman called Predictable Surprises: The Disasters You Should Have Seen Coming and How to Avoid Them. Yeah. And that book was really about the idea that, you know, most of the disasters that happen, you know, at least some people recognize them well in advance. In any organization, there were people that were already aware of it, right? But for some reason, that recognition and prioritization of that particular threat didn't happen the way it should have. Yeah. And so from that, I kind of built this little RPM model, I call it, right? Recognize, prioritize, mobilize, right? great strong strategic thinkers are able to recognize emerging threats and opportunities, and the opportunities are as important as the threats, prioritize the right things, and critically mobilize their organizations to do something about it. Yeah. And, you know, that RPM is, you know, it's RPM for a reason, right? Because the speed around that cycle is important. And there I drew on some work that was done actually by the U.S. Army before the, you know, before the Gulf Wars on how do you move faster than your opponent, right? How do you, the language that was used at the time was getting inside their decision loop so that they're still trying to, respond to the last thing you did while you're already enacting, you know, the future, right? So that notion of speed through that loop of recognize, prioritize, mobilize is pretty important. I haven't developed that as fully as I want to, right? So that's another, that sort of the value of speed around that loop is something I think I've got a little more work to do actually on, but that was the basis. And then from there, disentangle it into these sort of six disciplines, right? Which I view as kind of ways of thinking that contribute to your ability to do that RPM process, right? Pattern recognition, systems analysis, mental agility, right? That's recognize, prioritize, structured problem solving. That's how do you move your team in a rigorous, rapid way through complicated problem solving? Yeah. Visioning, you mentioned the future back. How do you not just vision, but you make it a shared vision and you communicate it powerfully and simply to align the organization? And then probably the one that surprised people the most about the book is the inclusion of political savvy as a discipline of strategic thinking. But, you know, the people I know, the leaders I know who are good at this are incredibly strategic in how they navigate through the political networks internally and externally, right? They're very, very, very good at knowing where power and influence lies, how to mobilize it. Things as simple as what's the right order to talk to people. I mean, there's a lot of strategy, right, in political savvy, and that's why I included it.
Michael, you pose a really interesting question that I'd love to get your view on, whether strategic thinkers are born or made. And one of the things you define strategic capacity as is endowment, experience, and exercise, almost like this formula. Could you unpack that for us, please?
So, you know, look, it would be arguably still interesting to write a book on strategic thinking if the answer was John either is or is not. Right? He's born with it or he isn't, you know, end of story. Yeah. I don't believe that. And it's not been my experience, right? That's the case, because I think there's a lot you can do to build up people's strategic thinking capability, but there are limits, right? Before I was a leadership professor, I was a negotiation and diplomacy professor at Harvard, right? So I was studying big international negotiations and teaching programs on negotiation. And, you know, there was no question that at the end of a semester-long program on negotiation, people were demonstrably better negotiators than when they started the program, right? Now, how much more? Is it 10%? Is it 20%? It's certainly not 50%, you know. But, you know, I mean, the joke I always used to make at the end of those programs is, you know, okay, I've made you 20% better negotiators. I want a piece of the action for every negotiation you engage in, right, for the remainder of your lives, right, for that. Because, you know, you think about it through the whole sweep of all the work you do, a 10% increase in performance is huge, you know. So then, Arjun, back to your point, that little formula, right, you know, the way I conceptualized it is, look, we do have an endowment cognitively and emotionally. We do, right? You know, I mean, we know from things like IQ curves, and I definitely don't want to get into dodgy territory here, right? But there's just no question that people come with different levels of what would be called general intelligence, you know? And I think it's equally clear that strategic thinking ability is correlated to some degree with some of those parameters, right? Now, you know, I very quickly then go to multiple intelligences, and, you know, the kind of EQ that underpins political savvy is also important, right? So we don't want to pin it all on IQ. But even there, you see people who are more naturally able to tune into what people are caring about, are better at reading the room. And it's just something inherent in the way their brains are structured, right? So I kind of wanted to both point that out, but also kind of take it off the table, you know, a little bit, if that makes sense, and say, okay, you know, yeah, you're gonna have this endowment. The experience is all the things you've done to help develop and realize your capacity up to the point in time when, you know, maybe you're a, you know, in early adulthood, right? When things begin to kind of become a little less fluid. My poor children, right? I was thinking 20 years ago about what the world was going to look like when they became adults, and I was already pretty concerned, you know, at that point. And so, you know, we played games, right? My civilization strategy games, you know, we did exercises on word connection at the table. And, you know, I'm sure it's going to create multiple years of future therapy for my children, but, you know, I helped them develop their strategic thinking capability, right? And there's no question that I did. What I did helped them. Yeah, I did other things, right? They all went to wilderness camps and learned how to, you know, be in the wilderness and survive physically, right? Because you just don't know what's going to happen at some level. My point is not that I'm crazy, although Arjun, you're looking at me like I am, and you may well be right. But as, you know, as the Billy Joel song goes, you know, you may be right, I may be crazy, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for, right? Kidding. Anyway, but I think that's the experience part, right? Which is, how do you help people through their developmental years, you know, build up their capability, right? And then the final one, which is, I think, the point in the book to a degree, is exercise, like literally having a cognitive exercise routine that you do, and things you do with your team and otherwise that help really build up that capability. Yeah. I mean, I wrote, it's not in the book, but it's an article I wrote recently about, you know, a 30-minute cognitive workout daily, right? And it's things you would expect to see. You know, it's a bit of strategic journaling. It's read the news for 10 minutes, but try to see the connections between what's going on. It's playing games, right? So again, my poor children, right? We play Wordle and connections and one other game every day competitively, right? And so that's good for the brain. It just is. Yeah. I'm not a particularly gifted chess player. My children, especially my boys, wipe the floor with me fairly routinely. But I do chess.com's daily puzzle every day, right? Because it just gets you into the mode of thinking about action and reaction, move and counter move. It exercises certain muscles in the brain. And I think from there you get into, okay, how do you build strategic capability and thinking capability in your team? Because you shouldn't be the sole strategist, right, as a CEO. Anyway, hopefully that's helpful.
So let's pick up on the first of the six disciplines in terms of pattern recognition. How do smart executives avoid the intelligence traps, such as confusing pattern recognition with pattern expectation, or overclaiming, or having to be the expert, and so on? How do you help them to see more clearly what's really going on?
So it's exactly the right question, John, about this, right? Because I think, you know, human pattern recognition capability has been and is essential to our survival, right? You know, our ability to distinguish important threats and opportunities in the environment is part of what's made us successful as a species. You know, there's no question about that. Yeah. But there's lots of good research, and I know you're aware of this research, that shows that human thinking and reasoning capability can have real biases associated with it, right? And we can think in ways that are not so accurate or productive in some senses, right? I think to me, a lot of it is anchored around how do you help leaders be better at spotting the important signals in the midst of the noise of what they're experiencing, right? That's to me step one, right? Because if you can't see what's important, you have little, you're not even going to get to the step of reasoning about what it means and maybe falling into some of the traps that you fall into, right? And so, you know, and it gets us back to a little bit about how do you build this capability in people, right? I personally don't think there is such a thing as the general purpose strategic thinker, right? Most strategic thinkers are deeply immersed in the domains that they're operating in, right? The book talks a little bit about a healthcare CEO that I've worked with for quite a while. And this is a guy who's absolutely deeply immersed in U.S. healthcare. He knows it as well or better than anybody, right? And that enables him to see patterns. That enabled him, you know, 6 or 7 years ago to say a wave of consolidation is coming. And we're either going to, you know, be the consolidator or be the consolidatee, right? I mean, it's that kind of recognition that I think really makes the difference. Then I think you need to really, you know, I mean, let's not, you know, analytics is super important, right? You need to merge this with the ability that we have today to do strong analytics once you're kind of pointed in the right direction. You need to do checking against the biases, right? You know, are we operating on a sunk cost set of assumptions? Are we caught in overconfidence, you know, of some form? Are we doing good probabilistic reasoning about what is going on? You need to do those things, right? Because otherwise you can fall into some of the classic traps that people like Daniel Kahneman and others have so ably illustrated for us. Yeah. And then I think there's, you know, there's immersion, there's mentoring, right? There's almost apprenticeship is the way I think about it, right? You know, John's a great strategic thinker. Arjun's, you know, a promising strategic thinker. Arjun's going to be the apprentice to the master and learn about how John thinks about the world, right? And what does he look for out there? Yeah. So I think there are, again, things you can do to sort of help help build up that capability. Sorry about the voice. It's allergy season already.
Michael, let's move on to systems analysis. What advice can you give to help maintain a more holistic understanding of a corporate system given its inevitable complexity?
So, first of all, I think, Arjun, that complexity is at the core of most of the challenges that people are facing today, leaders are facing today, right? You know, the classic VUCA framework, which is probably 20 years old, but has never, in my opinion, been more relevant than it is today, right? It starts with volatility and then it goes to uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. But I think the heart of it is actually complexity, right? Because there's just so many moving parts in everything we're dealing with these days. And then, of course, you overlay uncertainty, you overlay rapid change and volatility in the way we've talked about it. That then leads to you to think, okay, well, how do I deal better with complexity, right? What are the tools at my disposal to help me navigate through highly complex situations? And, you know, systems analysis is among the best tools we have to do that, right? There are others. I mean, I would point to scenario planning as a way to kind of navigate through something related to complexity with a, you know, some uncertainty kind of thrown in, right? But at its core, you know, what a systems model is a powerful simplification of something really complicated, right? And powerful in the sense that it helps you really understand the key drivers of the system and the interactions and cause effects in the system. Simple because it lets you reason about something that otherwise would be overwhelmingly complicated to deal with. Yeah. And that's to me the core of the value of systems analysis. You know, now, you know, as we've talked about, AI arguably is letting us grapple with much more complexity than we previously were able to, right? And so, but I still think that systems analysis is important. And often AI is itself building systems like models of reality, right? Inside those neural networks. Yeah. The example I use in the book is organizational systems, right? So I personally do quite a bit of work on organizational design. And, you know, you need a way to think about organizations that's simple and powerful, right? And just thinking about them as a morass of, you know, interactions is not all that helpful, right? But when you start to say, look, there are key elements of the organization. There is strategy. There is structure. There is processes, right? There are capabilities, you know. And you can begin to imagine how you could use that diagnostically to start to look at the different pieces of your organization, right? Well, what is the strategy? Does the structure support the strategy, right? Are the processes and systems delivering what we need to realize the strategy, right? Do we have the people and capabilities in the organization? And you can sort of see by disaggregating something complicated into these elements, you can, to a degree, focus on the elements. And then you've got to put it back together. You've got to go, Arjun, you used the word earlier, back to the holistic view of fit among these pieces, yeah? So that's an example I use. And I think, you know, this is stuff I teach to my executives a lot, saying, look, you need a way to think systematically about organizations if you're really going to be the architect of transformation, as an example. You know? But I think any domain, right, modeling, systems modeling is valuable, right? Understanding tipping points, understanding feedback loops, understanding the language of systems analysis, even in and of itself, I think has a lot of value.
So you've created your model of the organization that simplifies and allows you to get a handle on complexity. You then talk about the third kind of discipline being this mental agility and how level shifting can help you to think more strategically. Can we talk about that?
Sure. So when I originally was sort of coming to the point of starting to write the book, I actually originally had seven disciplines, right? Which arguably probably would have been better than six from a sales point of view. I'm kidding, but it sounds better, right? All great things happen in sevens. But mental agility, I kind of package two things together, John, and in mental agility, and one's what you just talked about, which is that sort of cloud to ground thinking ability, right? To look at things from the big picture point of view, the more holistic Arjun point of view, dive down into the detail, but not get caught in the detail, and move with intentionality, you know, between the levels of analysis, and help people move between the levels of analysis, right? Another way, you know, a metaphor I use sometimes is that, are you on the dance floor or are you on the balcony watching the dance floor, right? Is another sort of way to think about it. This, by the way, is an example of something that you can exercise, right? You can start to think about, you know, I tell my executive program participants, right? Play with this in your team meetings, right? What's going on down on the ground level? If I stepped back up and looked at it from the higher level perspective, what would I be noticing about the group dynamic, right? The energy of the group. But the key to me is that it's the ability to move between the levels, but it's really critically the ability to do it with intention, right? Not get caught down in the weeds, not get caught up in the clouds, but really move in the way that's most productive, I guess, given the situation. And then the other discipline was really around the sort of chess master skill set, right? Of, you know, looking forward a couple of moves and thinking about, you know, counter moves and counter actions. And that pretty quickly intersects with pattern recognition, because we know chess masters see things in the chessboard configurations that mere mortals do not, right? They don't just see a set of pieces. They see energy. They see possibility, right? They see potential sequences of things to do, right? And there's some real, I think, value in that. So that's the packaging that I did of mental agility, if that makes sense.
Can we just stay with that sure. Ability to play out the game of consequences for a moment, because that, I think, is one of the more difficult aspects. I mean, a lot of people aren't great at chess simply because they haven't got the ability to and the discipline and the energy and the resilience to keep thinking things through. They'd like to think about the first move, the second move, maybe even the third move, but life is in the nth consequences, isn't it? It's in the 10th move.
It is.
How do you train people to do that, to kind of actually have the discipline and the motivation to keep thinking it through?
Play lots of chess. That's a joke. So I think there are But it unquestionably helps, right? Just, just doing that daily chess problem, right? You start to see more than one or two moves ahead, you know, even if you've never played chess. Mm. You start to see things and patterns start to emerge for you, a bit. So sometimes I think it's, it's certain simple things you can do, John, right? So they're, and again, I'd want to anchor this just not in you, but also with you and your team thinking through important things. And there was a U.S. general, and I haven't been able to find his name, sort of back in the Kennedy era, who was famous for basically asking one question, and the question was, and then what? Right? We're going to do X, Y, Z, and then what? X, Y, Z, then what? Right? You know, he kept pushing people to go through the exercise of thinking through consequence and beginning to, explore alternative points of view. I think scenario planning can help you with this, right? Some strong scenario work can help you think about the future and then maybe reason backward to where we want to take things. And I do think that future back thinking is valuable, right? To the extent that you can do it. Because you want to be, yes, you want to be envisioning where you want to go, but you also want to think directionally, how am I going to start to move the organization towards that? Yeah. Does that help, John?
Yeah. No, it's a big topic. And, in the time we've got, it's starting to just unlock a few thoughts for people about what they're not.
But actually, you just spurred one more thought for me, right? Which is, making sure your team has enough time to actually engage in strategic thinking and think things through. Most common excuse for why people don't do strategic thinking is I'm too busy running the business. And I always sort of, my reaction to that is, you mean you're too busy running the business into the ground, right? Because if you're not engaging in the strategic thinking, your business is not going to persist, So maybe sometimes it's just the act of devoting enough time to really working with your team through the consequences of the choices you're going to make. That's actually what the structured problem solving chapter gets into in a fair amount of detail too.
That's one thing I wanted to just touch on, because I think the beauty of thinking about the consequences is it really helps you break down and create this methodical approach to tackling challenges, right? So when it comes to structured problem solving and that discipline, how do you think about combining creativity and pragmatism? So the kind of juxtaposition of those two things as well.
So a colleague and I just wrote an article for Harvard Business Review magazine, January, February, on problem framing and reframing, Arjun, right? And the tendency that leadership teams have to jump to solutions without really thinking through the core of what the problem is, And I think that we also talk a little bit about the importance of both doing divergent and convergent thinking and devoting time to both those things, right? Knowing when to open it up, right? Brainstorming, but also there's a technique called framestorming, believe it or not, that's about what are alternative ways to frame the problem that we're facing. Yeah, that's a divergence. But then, of course, you've got to do the convergence, right? And so just the act of separating those processes, I think, helps, because the divergent is inherently, it's the creative part of what you're doing, right? I think the other piece of it is the connecting the dots piece, right? Which to me flows out of pattern recognition, but also out of dialogue about how do you see the connections between what's going on there? And again, what are the relevant ones we need to be paying attention to?
So I love the idea of framestorming and redefining the problem. Where can people find out more about how to do that?
So there's the January, February issue of Harvard Business Review. If you just go online, the title is, to solve a tough problem, reframe it is the title of the article. And it basically lays out a five-phase model for thinking about different ways to reframe problems. It's probably the best source.
Yeah, and I definitely recommend that. I really enjoyed that article. So the act of visioning, which is our next discipline, is perhaps one of the most challenging tasks for executives, as we've kind of covered a little bit before. Can you walk us through the kind of motivational drivers for constructing that compelling vision?
Absolutely, right. So, you know, and again, I try to be careful about framing up what this is in a useful way, right? Because the conventional wisdom is Arjun has a, you know, perfect vision of where things are going to go, and gosh, he's brilliant, and, you know, are we fortunate to have him, and, you know, on with the show, right? And I view, first of all, I believe leaders should start with a personal vision for where they think they want the organization to go. Like, I think that's a good place to begin, which is to have a point of view as a leader about where you want to go. But you very quickly should be, you know, making that the creation of the vision for the organization a shared activity, in part because it's going to inject, you know, more realism into it, in part because, you know, 97% of the time, I made that number up, the vision is not going to end up being exactly what happens, right? And you need to be able to flex in the face of it. And if it's just your vision, John, and it's not working out, then boy, you know, John, what an idiot, right? He had this vision, it wasn't realistic, you know, gosh, look where we are now. Again, joking. Whereas if you engage in a shared visioning activity with your team, using perhaps your vision as a starting point, and really get people to coalesce around this is the clear picture of where we're going to try to go and how we're going to feel if we get there and why it would be motivating to pursue that vision, there's true value in doing that, you know? But it also has this added value of when conditions change, we, you know, can make the shift to a new reality, because these days, you know, any vision you create now that's three or more years out is virtually guaranteed not to work out the way you hope. Now, I still think the vision is important, right? Having that destination is important, directionally taking your organization towards it, but also acknowledging, you know, that you're going to need to flex almost inevitably as you do that. And then I think, you know, good visions, I think you use the word motivational drivers, they tap into people, things people care about, right? You know, achievement, achieving something great, winning, you know, I mean, let's face it, people love to often, right, in business, feel like they're winning. So as you're doing the work of visioning, making sure it's sort of psychologically and motivationally sound work and taps into those underlying motivators. And then in that chapter, I also talk about powerful simplification, right, which is the idea that a vision that can't be communicated powerfully and simply isn't very useful, right? The whole point is to try and align the energy, I'll go back to energy, right, to pull people energetically forward. And if you can't communicate that powerfully and simply, you know, it's just not going to do that.
Friends, if you're enjoying The Evolving Leader, I encourage you to order a copy of John's new book, Leading in a Non-Linear World, which provides a new understanding of mindset and how to build it in order to thrive in a more uncertain future. It's available online at all major retailers, and there's a link in the show notes.
You spoke earlier about the political skill and savviness of leaders being super important, and I imagine it's part of the reason why so many leaders have become successful. It's their kind of proficiency in that area. But how do you think they should overlay this and think about this in the context of strategy and strategic thought?
So it gets a little tricky, Arjun, because we're kind of in the, you know, the intersection of strategy and execution to a degree, right? I mean, one way to think about political savvy, and by the way, when I use political savvy like this, I'm kind of almost implicitly assuming that you're doing it to achieve important, valuable things and not just for purely self-aggrandizement, yeah. And I taught negotiation and diplomacy for many years and view this at, you know, as a technology, right? There's a technology of influence. There's a technology of negotiation. And the way that technology is used, right, you know, can vary widely, yeah? So I'm focusing more on the, okay, Arjun, you want to move your organization forward. You want to make that big acquisition. I'll use a concrete example, right? But in order to make that acquisition, you need to, you know, have approvals from three states and the Federal Trade Commission, and you need your board to be on board with that. And so you've got a lot of alliance building and negotiating to do, right? And so the strategic thinking there is, it's less about the fact that you're kind of creating a strategy, and more about you're being strategic in how you're doing this work. You're being thoughtful about who are my stakeholders. You're being thoughtful about what are the networks of influence that are operating here. You're thinking through momentum, right? And how you build momentum behind something. That's the strategic part of political savvy, in my view. Yeah. And the people who are good at it, you know, I talk about Gene Woods, the CEO I mentioned, who, you know, it's an amazing story, right? He, when I started working with him, he was leading a, you know, significant but modest-sized healthcare system, you know, in the Southeast U.S. And today he's leading one of the largest healthcare systems in the country, in the United States. And that was done by multiple, you know, combinations and deals that no one thought was possible, right? So this guy is just an absolute master of building those alliances in support of getting great things done. And that's political savvy at its finest to me.
So Michael, as we come to the end of our time together, what's next for you? What are you,
Well, you know, right, there's two answers to that question, John. One is what should I be doing? And the other is what am I interested in these days, right? You know, what I should be doing is finishing the third edition of the first 90 days. That's what I should be doing, you know, and it is what I'm going to focus on next. But, you know, what's so hard about that is just, and we talked about it, just there's so much interesting going on right now, right? That it's hard not to, you know, to get pulled into writing about some of this. So, I mean, I've recently written articles about getting two AIs to talk to each other. I've written an article about general purpose technologies. I've written an article that was co-authored by both of, you know, ChatGPT and Gemini, you know, together. I mean, you know, doing stuff like this. I've written, well, we didn't get into mindfulness, but I've written an article about mindfulness and leadership, right? I mean, you know, you might even think I'm a little unfocused at the moment if, you know.
Well, I'm just wondering, what would the author of this book say to you right now?
Exactly. Physician, heal thyself is what the author of that book would say. Set your priorities. And yeah, but I think it's a product of the times, right? And I'm sure like you guys, you know, there's just so much that's important and interesting going on. And you kind of want to be part of the conversation to a degree. And it's really hard to resist doing that. And also there's so much going on with AI at IMD, at Genesis, that it's hard not to get pulled into it. Yeah. Which I guess goes to show you that I need a serious strategic thinking workshop, right, or something. To get me back on track.
For yourself, yeah. Well, when I was reading the book, I mean, one of the things that, you know, is the perennial challenge for leadership teams I'm working with at the moment is how to prioritize. And it's almost like it's an existential crisis for many leadership teams, because they go round and round in this, you know, conversation, never really arrive at anything. And reading your book, you know, I recognize just how true that was for me and my organization as well, you know. I think
it's never been more important, John, right, than it is now, for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. But this is where I want to, you know, just because I don't often make such a strong endorsement of the books that our guests bring. But I really do recommend that everybody gets themselves a copy of this, whether you're at the start of your career or you're in the midst of it. I think some of it you'll already understand and know. But there's so much here in terms of pulling together a very clear framework for people that will provide some alleviation of the anxiety that, you know, we're feeling right now, which I think is a great testament to it. So Michael, just on behalf of Arjun, myself, and the whole of the Evolving Leader team, thank you so much for being generous with your time, giving us so much of the insights into your work, And you know, at some stage, we'd love to have you back on again if you're willing to do that, to talk about all the other things that we didn't get round to. But for now, until
all my other
time,
distractions, John. Right? No, I'm kidding.
We'll hear about all the other things that you shouldn't be doing, but you have been doing, which will be truly wonderful. And we always love Canadian guests. They seem to blend the perfect match of European philosophical and humane thought with American drive. So we love that that mix.
Thank you.
But anyway, to our audience, that's it. And until the next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?